The title of my sermon today is called A Search for Meaning. And it starts with talking about my search for meaning a little bit this past little while. Let me begin this way. I'm going to take two steps back for a second, just two. If there's children age of five or younger, and it would be easier or more effective for you to be able to enjoy the service if they were in nursery, there is a nursery provided for them. It's just out the back doors there to the right, and you'll see a nursery there. However, they're welcome to stay in the service as well. Also, just a reminder to my music team or my sound booth team, they asked me to remind them to record the sermon. Thanks, guys. You're the best. By the laughter, they remembered. Okay. Let's get back into it. I'm not supposed to laugh when I preach because it's distracting. I'm sorry. I haven't preached in over a year now here in front of all of you. To the teenagers, but I mean, but in front of all of you, I haven't preached in about a year. And so I'm a little extra nervous this morning because I'm just feeling out of my comfort zone. So I apologize for my nerves. Let's dig into this. Last year, Chris was on sabbatical, and I was preaching in his place. And while he was away, I worked incredibly hard and overworked in many ways and spent a lot of time here. And I reached a level of tiredness that probably I've never been at before, an exhaustion. And this past year was difficult for me as a result. And between me and some people in the church, there was some conflict that rose up. And I handled that conflict poorly. And our leadership in our church determined that it was an important time for me to take a step back and work on some personal growth and discipleship and following Jesus. And so they asked me to step back from some of my leadership roles, which I did, one of the reasons why I haven't preached in over a year, to take time for personal growth for myself, spiritual growth in my relationship with God, and to work on my marriage as well. For in the time that we were in sabbatical, Chris was on sabbatical, my wife and I didn't spend a lot of time together because I was here way too much. And so Kathleen's my wife, for those of you who are just visiting, we embarked on this together. It wasn't just for me, we decided that this was for us. And so we decided to focus some time, and it's been about 8 months now that we've been focused in this way, focused on developing and growing as Christians, as a husband and a wife, and as a pastor. And there's been good benefits to this time. Anyone, I think, would benefit from a time of being able to do a little less work and focus a whole lot more on their marriage and on God. And I'd encourage you that if it's possible to do that, because it has its benefits. And so we have benefited, and it's been a worthwhile journey, despite the many times that I've pushed against it and expressed frustration with it. Kathleen and I have come to learn a lot about ourselves and about God. And we've gotten a number of new insights. I personally have gained a number of new insights about who I am and myself and some of my personality and some of the things that have shaped me in my past that I didn't think had shaped me. I learned more about God than I've taken the time to learn before in a different way. Yeah, I've studied the Bible and I've studied God, but to really come to know God, that's different. And I've learned a lot about marriage this past few months. And I think Kathleen and I are at a place in our marriage that we didn't even know existed and is better, I think, than anywhere we've been. And we're excited to see what other areas of marriage we haven't explored or learned about yet that may exist that we don't know. That people tell us about, like married couples that have been married way longer than us. They tell us, like, oh, it gets better, this is great. And we're like, sure. But this is, okay. And so this morning and the next two sermons, I'm going to be talking a bunch about some of what I've learned and some of the journey I've been on. And so I hope that one of the things I've learned is that the story of our lives, though often painful, though often difficult, it can be redeemed by God to glorify his name when we share it well with his people. And so that is my hope for this series of sermons. I'm also grounding them heavily in the Bible because I have no authority on my own. But the biblical text, the word of God, that carries weight, and I don't. So, but that's a different weight. So my intent this week, this next 3 weeks, is simply to encourage you with my story and with the biblical text, and I hope you can understand that's the heart that I'm coming at this from. So I apologize in advance if I offend. I hope I won't offend, I don't think. We'll see. So this process for me began with a search for meaning. And I didn't think that it did. I thought I knew what my life was about, and I thought I knew what my purpose and meaning was. But it turns out that in some ways I didn't. Like, I think I have some of the practical figured out correctly back then, but I don't think I necessarily had it figured out in the heart. I don't think I was doing it quite right. And so the process of character development for anybody begins with meaning, begins with why do I need this character? Why do I have to develop in this way? Why does any of this even matter at all? Character is developed in what we value most, and our character reveals where our heart is. When I began on this journey, I was in a difficult place because I didn't think that I mattered. I didn't think that I had meaning. You see, 7 years ago, no, more than that, four, five, six, no, 7 years ago. 7 years ago, I was a youth pastor for the first time in a church. And after 8 months working in that church, they fired me. And they replaced me the same day. In other words, they had already been looking for my replacement. They let me go, and that evening they had a different person running the youth programs. And that person is still running those youth programs at that church. One of the things I got from that, there's a number of things that false and bad teachings I taught myself from that, like I can't rely on a church, I have to rely on myself, I can't trust God, he won't keep me in ministry. Those are things that I taught myself or told myself at that time, which aren't true. But the other thing I taught myself was that I don't matter. It doesn't matter if I'm the youth pastor or not, because I can be replaced the same day. If I were to leave Brightview, it would hardly be marked and it wouldn't matter. If I screw up and things go bad, that doesn't matter. Someone else can go in and do it and I'll just leave. And I lived from this perspective that I don't matter, that my impact wouldn't matter, and that what I do in ministry ultimately doesn't matter because God's will is greater than mine, and if I screw it up, God will fix it. And I believe that other people matter, but I don't matter, which is a self-defeating perspective, and yet I was in it. And from that mindset, I was unable to deal with the conflicts that arose around me, and more conflicts arose around me because of it, I think. And I'm not necessarily saying that I'm out of that mindset entirely. I think I'm still working through some of that. Ultimately, everything I strive for in my work, in my mind, was meaningless. From this heart of meaninglessness, conflict with others gets harder. And you can't respond to it well, because who cares what they think of me? Who cares if they're upset with me? Who cares if I'm upset with them? It doesn't matter. It's all meaningless. And so this morning I want to explore the issue of meaninglessness. And there's really one biblical book that handles this better than the rest. So let's open to Ecclesiastes. We're not going to read the whole book of Ecclesiastes, but I'm going to survey the book of Ecclesiastes this morning. In Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 1 to 3, he writes his thesis. It defines the whole book. These first three verses give us the picture of the whole rest of the book of Ecclesiastes. And it says this, verse 1, the words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem, meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What does man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? That resonated with me heavily, and I've quoted that out of context many times to people. Meaningless, meaningless, everything is meaningless. Utterly meaningless. In other versions, I might say vanity, vanity, utter vanity. The writer of the book of Ecclesiastes was a philosopher, a wise man, someone who studied logic and reason, and he based his logic and reason on observation, on experience, on what he could reason of his own mind. And so the book of Ecclesiastes is written from the perspective of human logic, observation, and experience. It is not written as a theology, but as a philosophy. And so the first three verses lay out what the conclusion of all of his philosophical reasoning, observation, and life experiences conclude is that it's all for nothing. It's meaningless. But the pursuit of the book is to answer the hardest question, the most important question in this world, under the sun, if you will. And that question is, what is the meaning of life? He determines the answer is not 42, but that it's meaningless. The solitary laughter, love it. That's how youth groups operate. Like, you make a reference like that, and like one teenager gets it and just cracks up. Anyways, Okay, I'm like a like that dog from Up, squirrel. Anyways. So we are on, as human beings, we're on a journey to discover the meaning of life. That's much of us live most of our lives on that journey, trying to figure out what the meaning of life is. And many of us may have a quick Sunday school answer. Well, it's Jesus. The meaning of life is Jesus, obviously. It's God. It's love. It's, you know, it's good. And you're right. You're definitely not wrong. In fact, that's the conclusion I've come to. And yet the interesting thing is that for that answer, it did not fulfill my need or my search for meaning. The author of Ecclesiastes is searching for the meaning of life. And so he tries five approaches to the meaning of life. Five approaches. We're going to explore those five this morning. The five approaches are knowledge, pleasure, power, altruism, and religion. We're just going to break each one of those down. Because I think I myself have also pursued each of these, and perhaps many of you have as well, in the search for meaning. So let's just go through them and see how we do. The first three of these, we're going to call them toils under the sun. Okay, we're pulling straight out of the text. Verse 3 of chapter 1 says, what does man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? This is repeated throughout the text of Ecclesiastes. He points out that everything we do, toil is activity or action, work, labor, the things we do. Under the sun is that which is, you know, under the sun, so the earth. Everything we do under the sun is ultimately meaningless. So the first three toils are the self-indulgent toils, the self-indulgent labors, knowledge, pleasure, power. They're self-indulgent. They're about me. Knowledge is to fill the mind, pleasure to fill the body, and power to fill the pockets. These same three labors that are ultimately meaningless, according to the author, are the same three temptations that Eve received in the garden. That the fruit was good for knowledge, it was pleasing to the eye, and it will make her like God. Those same three temptations line up perfectly with these three labors or toils or pursuits. And many of us are tempted by these same three things and pursue them ourselves constantly. We catch ourselves in cycles of pursuing our pleasures, pursuing knowledge, or pursuing power. Let's start with seeking knowledge. In Ecclesiastes 1, verse 16 to 18, he expresses his seeking of knowledge. Verse 16 of chapter 1. I thought to myself, look, I have grown and increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I've actually honestly thought that, aside from the whole Jerusalem ruling part, but like, look at me, I've increased in wisdom and knowledge. I am smarter than all the youth pastors. Not senior pastors, they're all smarter than me, but youth pastors. I have experienced much wisdom and knowledge. Then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly. But I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind, which is his phrase for it's pointless, it's meaningless. Now, it's important to note here that he doesn't just pursue knowledge, but he also pursues folly and madness. He does not just go to being, well, intelligence is the key, but I'm also going to check out what it is to have no intelligence. And he determines that both, in the end, are equal in terms of their meaninglessness. You see, this is where I tend to sit. And I think that this is where the writer, being Solomon, or essentially, it's debatable whether it's Solomon. Probably Solomon, who wrote Ecclesiastes. And he was a wise man, a philosopher, a thinker. For him, he thought wisdom would certainly be the answer. He would certainly find the meaning of life there. I have thought that. Any that work with me or have spent any time with me, you'll see that I lean heavily on my education and on my knowledge and my intelligence. Young adult time is, when we do the teaching time, tends to be pretty heavy in the teaching. And that's kind of where my focus is, sometimes to our detriment. The road to knowledge, unfortunately, leads to further despair, not meaning. For me, I have pursued knowledge in a desperate hope. When I was young, I was heavily bullied. My first day of public school in grade 5, I was beaten up on the playground. And from that day forward, I was marked as an easy target, and I was bullied through most of my elementary and high school years. I hardly went a week without being hurt physically in some way, having garbage thrown at me, thrown into lockers, or my nose broken. And so I realized physically I had no chance against these guys, but I was smarter than them. And so I would pursue my intelligence. I would outstrip them in terms of logic and knowledge. I would become something more than them and be a greater person. I pursued intelligence out of a desire to escape them, those who had hurt me. I also saw being intelligent as a way to get freedom. It was a way to free myself, one, from those who would hurt me and harm me, but also away from those in authority. Because those in authority didn't really stand up for me either in those situations in the schools. And so I didn't want their authority to be over me. And that is an issue I still have today. I struggle with authority over me and allowing them to be authoritative. But by being smarter than those in authority, I put myself above them. It's an attempt to be free from control. But ultimately, the pursuit of intelligence is a pursuit of power, the right or ability to pass judgment on others, and ultimately to be able to pass judgment on God. I know better than the Almighty. This pursuit of knowledge is ultimately meaningless, for even the greatest wisdom of man is foolishness in the eyes of God. No matter how smart we get, you are nothing in God's eyes in terms of intelligence. But there is a knowledge that can fulfill. This is what I talked about at the beginning, that there is a knowledge that I've come to of God that didn't come from all my study of books and my years in seminary. And I don't know if I'm fully there. I'm just starting to touch the edge of it, just the edge of his cloak, as it were. Just seeing the first glimpses, I think. But in 2 Peter chapter 1, it talks about the knowledge of God and how the knowledge of God brings so much more. Maybe I'll just quickly flip to it. I didn't bookmark it, but it shouldn't take long to find 1 Peter. 1 and 2nd, 3rd John, 1 and 2nd Peter. Nope, 1 2nd Peter, 1 2nd 3rd John. Come on, Andrew, know your Bible. It says this. His divine power, this is verse 3 of chapter 1, 2 Peter. His divine power has given us everything we need for life and godliness through our knowledge of him, who called us by his own glory and goodness. Through these, he has given us his very great and precious promises, so that through them you may participate in the divine nature and escape the corruption of the world caused by evil and desires. For this very reason, make every effort to add to your faith goodness, and to goodness knowledge, and to knowledge self-control, and to self-control perseverance, and to perseverance godliness, and to godliness brotherly kindness, to brotherly kindness love. For if you possess these qualities in increasing measure, they will keep you from being ineffective and unproductive in your knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. Our knowledge of God, it's not about what we learn in a book. It's not about our logical arguments. This past year, I studied apologetics heavily, and I can now, off the top of my head, give 5 good arguments for the existence of God and convince people through logical arguments that God is real, that God exists, that Jesus is who he claimed to be. I've memorized many of these arguments, and yet all that knowledge is not the knowledge of God. That's the knowledge, of logic, of argumentation. The knowledge of God comes from meeting him, submitting ourselves to his presence, pursuing his will. I just read it, but I've already forgotten the words. But goodness, adding goodness and brotherly kindness and love and self-control to our understanding of who God is. The second toil under the sun is the seeking of pleasure. In the search for meaning, pleasure is low-hanging fruit. It's easy. It's readily available. Pursuing pleasure is simple. Pleasure promises a greener pasture. You're not loving how things are today? Try this out. It'll make you feel better. It looks better. It promises happiness. Pleasure drives our vices and our habits. Pleasure invites us to indulge in ourselves and ignore God. I'm one who has sought pleasure in a number of ways. I eat how I want to eat. I drink what I want to drink. I play a lot of video games and board games. And when I was in high school, there was a year in which I spent pursuing women. And that was a difficult time because that was most empty I ever felt. And every relationship I had with those girls, it left me more empty. And so each new relationship I pursued further. I pushed the boundaries and risked more. Fortunately, I was protected, I believe, by God, and I did not lose my purity, and yet I still pursued my own pleasure and these girls. Now, it's not wrong to experience pleasure, that moment, that feeling, but we must not confuse pleasure with happiness, and we must not confuse happiness or pleasure with meaning, but we often do, because it's easy, but it's shallow. It's like walking in ankle deep into a lake and saying, I swam in the whole lake. Or walking around the outside edge and saying, I crossed it as swimming. And someone says, wow, aren't you tired? No, I just kind of walked around the edge. Pleasure is shallow. It's largely meaningless and fleeting. True pleasure, that which does fulfill us, that which does meet this inner need, this happiness that we seek, it flows out of purpose, and it abounds in the revelry of God's presence. A true pleasure, a deep pleasure, a meaningful pleasure comes when God is present in it, not when we try to find it on our own. It's a gift, not something to be gained, but something to be given. The third of these first three is seeking power. Now, all three of them could be said to be seeking power ultimately. Power is the deeper of the desire, is a deeper desire than pleasure, because pleasure pursues itself. Power allows for this pursuit without limitation and at will. If I have power or wealth, I am able to pursue my pleasures without ever being stopped. In the garden, Eve was tempted by the desire to be like God. It was a temptation for power. I've also sought power for the same reasons that I sought intelligence. In fact, I sought intelligence to gain power. I want power so that I cannot be hurt, and I seek power so that I will not be criticized. Power tempts me with the invitation to freedom. If only I had a little more. If only I had a little more power, a little more control. If only I had a little more money. It's this temptation for wealth and power. So I don't have them together, but wealth and power are the same temptation, because wealth is always linked to power in our culture. And that temptation is very strong for those who live in poverty or with low means, because it always promises that if I get a little more, it'll be better. And then I get a little more, I'll be better. And you get a little more, and I just need a little bit more, and I'll be better. And we always pursue. But Solomon exclaims, and I didn't write down the verse, so I apologize for that, but he exclaims that he has had all the wealth of Jerusalem, the greatest wealth in the kingdom. And yet he laments that upon his death or demise, someone else will get it. And who knows whether they will use it well or not. It doesn't matter that he has all of this wealth, because when he dies, he cannot take it with him, and someone else will take it. And so it's ultimately meaningless. There is a power that is real and true and fulfilling. It's a power that is not found under the sun. And that's, we must remember, Ecclesiastes is written about work under the sun. It misses that which is not under the sun. And so true power comes from the risen sun. This power is not the taking of power for the self, but it is submission, a surrender to the power of God, which is so backwards, and yet it's correct, as far as we can tell. Now, after pursuing wisdom and pleasure and power, the writer of Ecclesiastes moves on, and he goes, I found nothing in these, they are meaningless. And so he moves on. The writer of Ecclesiastes moves on from the self-indulgent, and he begins to seek meaning outside of himself. Perhaps my life isn't about me, but about others. And that's exactly what I did. So you'll notice that most of my stories up till now have been about my younger years, my adolescent years. I decided it wasn't worth living for myself, and so I began to live for others. And so we seek altruism. The author of Ecclesiastes begins to live for others. He gives away from his massive wealth. He provides for others. He gives opportunity to others. He builds great structures for his people. See, living for others is considered a virtue. It doesn't seem like it should belong on this list. But even after the author of Ecclesiastes does, as much altruism as he is able, he declares at the end it's a chasing after wind and it's meaningless. He figures it this way. If his meaning in his life is a cup, and he tried to fill it with pleasure, power, and wisdom, and found it all to be empty still, then giving away an empty cup doesn't fill the cup. It just gives somebody else an empty cup. He determines that if he gives away all of his knowledge, all of his pleasure, gives away his power, he's not benefiting that person because all he's doing is giving them the same meaninglessness he already had. You give someone an empty cup and they look in it expecting a drink of water and there's dust. There's a deep feeling of meaninglessness that washes over. I too have lived for others. This might be a little bit edgy, but I was raised in a Christian home. I was taught that service was a great virtue. I've served in the church. I've sacrificed much of my own time and energy. And yet all of it I did on my own strength. I realized I jumped ahead on my notes, so I'm just going to keep going. I did it all on my own strength. And when I offered to people what I had, it was just an empty cup because it wasn't God most of the time. It was me. I gave them my energy, my passion. I gave them my intelligence. I gave them what I had to give and did not give what God had to give. So the cup was empty. There is an altruism that fulfills, and it begins with receiving a fullness from Jesus. It begins with the living water. It begins by having him fill the cup so that you actually have a cup with something in it to give away. But most of the time, I just filled the cup myself. And when I gave it to somebody, they were disappointed to find it empty. The cup is empty when we fill it ourselves. Jesus offers to fill the cup until it is overflowing. Altruism fulfills when we are first filled by Jesus. So until we get the water from the source, the cup will remain empty. And this was the author's conclusion as well. He can't fill the cup himself. So he has nothing to give. So altruism is ultimately meaningless. So he moves to the final step, seeking religion. Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 14, is his lament on religion, I think. He says this, "When times are good, be happy. But when times are bad, consider God has made the one as well as the other. Therefore, a man cannot discover anything about his future. In this meaningless life of mine, I have seen both of these, a righteous man perishing in his righteousness and a wicked man living long in his wickedness. Do not be over-righteous, neither be over-wise. Why destroy yourself? Do not be over-wicked and do not be a fool. Why die before your time?" He determines that good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people, and it doesn't seem to matter whether you're a Christian or not, although he didn't have Christianity at the time, but it didn't seem to matter whether he had God or not, because the way people lived and the reality of their life didn't seem to line up with that belief. You see, his religion, he pursued religion as his final attempt to find meaning, and he was not a fool. He did not declare that God did not exist, because that would make him a fool, according to Proverbs. However, he claims God exists, but that he doesn't see God doing anything for the people who believe in him. You see, he believes that God is distant, a mystery, one who cannot be understood, who has not revealed himself, that God is like the Force from Star Wars, in case you haven't caught that reference. Ambiguous, impersonal, indifferent, seeking some sort of balance. It didn't matter if you were a good person or a bad person, it just... life happened, and God is both present in, and he says it, he says he's God makes one as well as the other. And so what does it matter? This is a conventional religion. It does not bring fulfillment. This might be the part here where I'm being a little bit facetious, but I too have lived in a religious place. I grew up in a Christian church, a Baptist church, so it was correct. I grew up learning to pray and to tithe. I said a sinner's prayer. I participated in communion. I've been baptized. I stand when I sing and I sit during announcements. All the liturgies of the religion I have observed. I might even join with Paul in saying that I am a great Christian. But all of that is meaningless when it's done in practice only. There is a religion that fulfills, but it's not the religion of dead works, which has honestly been most of my faith. Life is found only in the one who is alive, and his nature is love. All the works of religion are meaningless and hollow if love is absent. Funny thing is, I know this cognitively. The theme verse for our youth group is, if I have not love, I am nothing. But I don't think I really understood it. Even now, I'm still struggling to understand that. All the works of religion are meaningless and hollow if love is absent. And I don't mean the abstract feeling of love, that butterfly in the stomach, heart racing. I don't mean that. Our English language doesn't do that well. I mean agape. I mean God as Abba, Father. Christ as lover of my soul. The bringer of life. The one who renews. The one who fulfills. True, meaningful, deep love. A love that for most of my life, and even today, I struggle to think that I'm even worthy of. A love that I don't think I'm worthy of. Ecclesiastes asks the question, what is the meaning of life? And the author concludes that after seeking an answer through observation, logic, and experience, that life is ultimately meaningless. And I echo his sentiment in many ways for my own life. This is where my journey began. This might be where some of you are. There's an important understanding here that there's an answer to this. Ecclesiastes ends originally without the final few verses. And so it actually ends in meaninglessness. And it leaves us asking the question, well, then what are we here for? Some of you might be in the same place as I've been. Maybe some of you are there right now where I don't want to say was, but was. I've made some steps, I think. See, Ecclesiastes is hell. The opposite of love is not hate, it's meaninglessness. It's emptiness. So Ecclesiastes is hell. And the answer to Ecclesiastes is heaven. So the good news is that Jesus has come into our hell. He entered into your hell for you, for me. He stated it in his teaching. It is the sick who need a doctor. I have not come to call the righteous, but the sinner. The way out of Ecclesiastes is to pursue love. But Ecclesiastes has already put us in a place of meaninglessness. And so the only path out of meaninglessness is through suffering. A more biblical phrase might be through the valley of the shadow of death. It is through suffering that we come out of meaninglessness and find love and hope. We find God. Now, there's more good news. Christ has suffered, both for us and with us. Our suffering has meaning because he has suffered. Because he suffered and came out victorious and conquered through his suffering, so also any suffering we experience will bring us through, has hope because we can conquer through it. Both with him and he has already done it for us, and so we know that it is possible. And so Christ walks with us as we walk through the valley of the shadow of death. So next week, we're going to pursue the worldview of the life as suffering. Now, I've been basing this series, of course, out of my own life and out of the Bible, But there's this book called The Three Philosophies of Life by Peter Kreeft. And he does this exact same sort of journey in his book in terms of walking through meaninglessness to suffering to love. And he concludes the first section, the section on meaninglessness, this way. And I just want to read it to you to conclude the sermon this morning. It says this, Ecclesiastes is a bright book of life. It is bright precisely in its dazzling darkness. It is a book of life precisely because it is honest and nakedly confronts the fact of death. It is a great, great book because it explores deeply the uncompromisingly and uncompromisingly a great question. What are our lives here under the sun for? That is the greatest question in the world. The only greater book than this would have to be a book that gave the greatest answer in the world. A book like the next book in the Bible, the Song of Songs. The philosopher asks the question, but the lover answers it. The head thinks, but the heart sings. In the Song of Songs, life is seen as a love song. Our lives are notes in a great music, a cosmic harmony, a music of the spheres. And the point of the song is love because the singer of the song is God. Our story, history, is his story. And God is love. The final line, I wasn't going to read it, but it says, but that is another story, and the way to it is by the way of Job, which is suffering. So next week, we're going to look at suffering and how we live in suffering and walk through suffering to pursue God. And we're going to look in the book of Job. Thank you for being patient with me this morning. Let's pray and have the music team come up to lead us in some music. God, you are the one who truly fulfills us. But most of us don't believe that you are enough for it. We might say the words, sing the songs, read the scriptures. But Lord, so many of us live each day trying to find meaning while knowing fully who you are. Lord, help us to come into your presence, to see that you are enough, that you provide meaning. Lord, help us to resist meaninglessness and to allow suffering so that we might find you and experience love. Lord, thank you for the work you have done in my heart and in my life this past year. And Lord, I pray that you continue to do that work in my life, but also in the lives of these in our church. I pray that you continue to do a good work in them, bringing them closer and nearer to you. That their knowledge would not be the knowledge of this world, but the knowledge of who you are and of the love that you have and the love that you are. I pray all this in your name, Lord. Amen.